Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable panel. There was a little miscommunication there. Normally, I will fire off a thumbs up to Liz, and then she'll open up her microphones. But she had said something to me in my headphones. Then I didn't hear her, so I was asking to hear back. But then the microphones came on, and then I didn't know exactly. So is everything okay? Are we all right? Oh, sure. Excellent. There you go. We're good. Okay. Let's try it again. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the roundtable. Welcome to the panel. Very nice to have you with us. It is a Wednesday morning. It's the 20th of September, and we're delighted to have you here and to share with us as we try to figure out what the hell is going on in our world. Good luck. But here we go. We're going to give it a shot. We have some wonderful minds to help us do that this morning. Mike Spain is the associate editor of the Times Union. He is with us this morning. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
David Soares is the district attorney of Albany County, and it's a great pleasure to welcome him back to the program. David, thank you very much for
being
here.
Good morning.
And Teresa Bourgeois is a communications consultant. She is brilliant, and she joins us this morning to share in that to share her brilliance with us.
Oh, how nice. On National String Cheese Day.
Is that what it is? That's very specific. String cheese.
I wanted to think of something happy. You know, Ray Graham says they can start the day with something happy.
My wife will be celebrating
it's
tonight.
National, yeah, big. I don't even know what string cheese is, but it's national. But Friday's National Ice Cream Cone Day. Now that's my day.
There you go. You can get into that. My special thanks to, Alan was going to be with us. I don't know if you heard his 7:45 commentary this morning, but he had a back operation. And so he did his commentary from his hospital bed.
Oh, my goodness.
And he didn't want to do the round table from the hospital bed?
Well, I think he
may, I think we're all feeling a little sick after yesterday.
I think he may be getting out. So I think he's going to go home and hopefully rest and be back with us tomorrow. So, but anyway, I found out about that late last night. I fired off an email to Mike in the wee hours of the morning, to which he responded. So I appreciate him coming in at the last minute and filling out the panel this morning. Let us go to what's happening in the world. Yesterday, first of all, thanks to Ray Graff. He filled in for me yesterday. I was out and had a cool gig at the New England Booksellers Association in Providence, Rhode Island. We were honoring your home. That's right. Is that your hometown?
That's right. Did you get any fish and chips and chowder?
I got chowder. I got two things of chowder. That was excellent. Didn't do the fish and chips, but I got scallops. It was very good. But I will say, I actually had to go to Pawtucket to find my dry cleaning, but that's a whole different story.
That sounds like
a tremendous story, but we probably won't hear
lost
it all.
No.
Did you catch the guy who stole it?
All I know is I gave it to a chambermaid at about 10 o'clock on Monday night, and at 3 o'clock I was going to Pawtucket on Tuesday to get my clothes because I was doing this dinner that was honoring the great John Irving.
Oh,
and
wow.
So it was a lovely, lovely time. We had a very good time. So,
that's called ransom.
Yes, I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right. So yesterday I had some things to do, but then I came back to my hotel and I sat down and I watched the speech, which we aired. And I know we talked about it leading up to the speech yesterday. And I know we also talked about it on Monday with Rosemary. And Teresa, of course, you were in that conversation, and we talked about what it meant, or what it could mean. So here are some of the highlights. In his first address to the United Nations General Assembly, President Trump brought his confrontational style of leadership. While his tough words were cheered by Israel and Republican lawmakers, leaders of France, the European Union, and the UN were critical. He threatened to totally destroy North Korea. He once again referred to President Kim Jong-un as Rocket Man, and he said that many nations may declare parts of the world would be going to hell. It was a bombastic speech, and certainly not unlike a lot of the political events that he does throughout the country. met with, as the New York Times points out, stony silence as to the UN crowd. And there's a lot to discuss, and I want everyone's sort of general view of what happened yesterday, but then hopefully going into this idea of sovereignty, which is something that he mentioned 21 times during his address yesterday in the 41-minute speech to the United Nations. So, Mike Spain, I'll begin with you.
Well, it does seem that we've given up our role, at least temporarily, as the leader of the free world. You know, the United Nations is in New York City for a good reason. After World War II, when we led the world in the fight and the victory over Nazism and fascism, we wanted to engage in conversation, and it was a perfect place to do it. In fact, John Meacham, the historian, said the other day on one of the morning TV shows that FDR had hoped to have a airstrip put in Hyde Park and have world leaders, when they came to the UN, fly up and spend the afternoon with them, and he'd give them his counsel and advice during his retirement after his presidency. And, you know, it just underscores that the United States has historically held this leadership role since the middle of the 20th century, and I guess we're temporarily putting that on the shelf.
David Soares.
Well, first of all, like, I have to say that I was just sad, quite honestly. You know, I'm accustomed to hearing this man speak and the language that he uses, the profanity, but yesterday I was left saddened because we've always played a significant role in the United Nations. We've always approached our role with reason, acknowledging what other nations are experiencing. And yesterday, I just felt that we've completely abandoned our leadership role in the United Nations. And that was tragic, you know, in my opinion. And, you know, I do take exception to some of the commentary that I've heard over the last 24 hours, where they were trying to normalize this man's speech and the fact that he had given some credit to Truman and the fact that he, you know, mentioned the Marshall Plan. Well, you know, if you think about the League of Nations, you know, the League of Nations, this was the organization after the First World War that we were looking to establish so that we can deal with international issues in a more peaceful way. And as you recall, that was a complete failure in our part because our Congress wouldn't even allow for us to join the League of Nations. And so we took a very isolationist posture after the First World War. And I couldn't help but reflect on that as I'm listening to this president, although he's talking about the Marshall Plan and Truman, he was taking a gigantic step back in the world stage.
I do want to get to Teresa, but I'm fascinated by exactly what you mentioned, David, because I was going to bring this up, which is that over the past 24 hours, we've seen from the headlines and sort of just the shock of the very strong words that were said on the floor of the United Nations by the President of the United States, that I was listening to an interview with David Ignatius, who is somebody I respect and I think is a very good pundit and writer. His point is that if you take away the bombast, that you had a fairly boilerplate speech by a president to the United Nations. But how do you get past these nations are going to hell? How do you get past
totally destroy North Korea?
To totally destroy North Korea. And the point was made, and as you say, and the normalization, the point was made of, well, maybe this is what is needed for this guy. Nobody else. This is another pundit talking point last night, which was, well, maybe this is what we need in this situation. Nothing else has worked. So let somebody fight fire with fire. It's risky, sure, but let's give it a shot. And I for one, find it very difficult to get over that bombast and to separate the two.
Well, you know, and this is not just an abstract, you know, issue that we're here having discussions about. There are people in South Korea waking up, looking at themselves and wondering, like, what is going on? And the idea that you would have the president of the United States, right, sitting here almost trying to provoke and engage this person who I think we all agree in the president of in terms of the leadership in North Korea, I think we can all agree, man's unstable. And the idea that you're a South Korean, an ally of the United States, and you're turning on your television in hope that what's going to happen during his speech is some tampering down of the rhetoric. And instead, no, this man walked into the United Nations with a can of gasoline and matches, and he just basically started a fire there.
And Teresa, it seems as though we have become accustomed to seeing this type of verbiage in tweets, but to have it in an official context as a representative of the United States of America on the floor of the, stress this word, United Nations, seemed, at least to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, but just seemed very out of place.
It was not the kind of, it's the kind of speech that has been heard before at the UN, but not by the President of the United States of America. And when a speech like that has been given at the UN, other people have resoundingly denounced it. And by, you know, leaders who are considered on the fringes. But what struck me, you know, my business, what I do is work with people on strategic communications, on messaging. You know, what's your goal? What are you trying to accomplish? Do you have a common message? Is your message consistent across all your platforms and with what you're trying to accomplish? And one of the things that struck me about the speech, you know, people can agree, disagree. I strongly disagreed with it. But it was so internally inconsistent. Parts of the speech contradicted many other parts of the speech, and it was inconsistent with his budget proposals and with his actions in many cases, and also inconsistent with how he campaigned. So it just seemed, what struck me also is that he read those words, Rocket Man. He did not improvise them. Somebody wrote that.
We assume Stephen Miller.
Yeah.
That's Stephen Miller, right?
Right, Stephen right. Miller.
Although there was I watched a whole discussion last night late on cable news about the differentiation between a Stephen Miller and Stephen Bannon speech versus just a Stephen Miller speech, where they were saying that some of the isolationist language was taken out of it, but you were still left with this a very obviously strongly worded statement, so that you could see the Stephen Miller impact.
What struck, because I listened on the radio, and then I went back last night, C-SPAN replayed it, and so I watched it on C-SPAN, and you could tell.
Yeah, I don't want to miss that again.
Yeah, no, because I was so, I know it sounds crazy, but I was horrified by it, and was curious to say, was he reading that or not? And some of the parts that, when I listened to it, I thought, oh no, he went off script. He was actually reading some of the stuff. But the key thing that he said is he denounced North Korea for being out of bounds in the global community for threatening to use nuclear weapons. And so then his response to that was to threaten to use nuclear weapons against North Korea. So that what he admonished, he then said he was going to do.
Which I think we're all accustomed to seeing and hearing to the rhetoric of North Korean leadership. I mean, we've grown up listening to this. It's a different day when we hear the President of the United States engage in that kind of violent rhetoric. And in fact, the last time that I watched a speech delivered from the floor of the United Nations where that kind of language was used was by the former president of Iran after George Bush had gotten up
and
spoke.
Exactly right.
And then it was President Mahmoud
Ahmadinejad
right. who got up and talked about smelling sulfur from the podium because he followed George Bush after that speech. And that was one of the more troubling remarks I've heard from the UN. But I think we have a new champion there.
Right. And so that's what I was saying. It's not that we have not heard that kind of speech before at the UN. It's just, it's always been an outlier. But, you know, so how do you, at the one hand, admonish the you know, head of North Korea for threatening to use nuclear weapons by threatening to use nuclear? And so whether you agree or disagree with that policy, if you are other countries' leaders, how do you take these remarks? Do you take them seriously or not? And when he talks about all of the good that we're doing, clearly there was a couple paragraphs in there that I presume are Nikki Haley's or somebody's or Tillerson's about the Food for Peace and programs and such. That's lovely language, if only it were true. But if you look at his budget proposal...
Right, he wants to cut those programs.
He wants to cut the programs. The little bit of the speech that was about diplomacy and about UN humanitarian aid was completely inconsistent with what his budget proposals are and what he's doing at the State Department.
John Negroponte, who is the former U.S. Deputy Secretary of State, was on with a panel of military leaders last night, and I was watching that. And they were basically, I wouldn't say praising the speech, but they were saying that it wasn't as bombastic as it appeared. But one of the things that came up within that conversation was, well, okay, but we're talking about if we attack, what impact is that going to have on South Korea? I mean, it's just going to wreak complete havoc. And you got the sense from those, and I don't want to put words in their mouth because I have the quotes here, but basically kind of that shrugging of the shoulders of, well, that's the cost of doing business. And, you know, and in that I just find frightening.
What I find troubling is the short-sightedness of this administration in many ways, but particularly when we're talking about war. There's no country that goes to war in the 21st century without the support of other allies. It's impossible. And so what happens when you're in the UN and you're delivering those speeches and you're alienating your allies?
I'm going to stop you there. When we come back, we're going to talk about this a lot more. We have to take a news break, the BBC, find out what else is going on in the world. We'll do that. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Mike Spain, David Soares, and Teresa Bourgeois making up the panel this morning. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Talking mostly so far about the president's speech to the United Nations. He continues at the United Nations today. There will be more work to be done today and tomorrow. Let's go to some letters. We go to Gina, who says, in keeping with the Elton John theme of Kim Jong-un is Rocket Man, then Trump is our madman across the water. Incredibly sad. Claude says sovereignty was the key word in his bellicose speech. He said all countries need to protect themselves, so why can't North Korea and Iran have bombs to protect themselves and their sovereign nations? Sovereignty, 21 times in the speech.
At the United Nations.
At the United Nations.
Well, it's a place, it's an institution that was formed to leave sovereignty behind and to celebrate and to build by working together. I mean, he basically got up there and put his thumb in their face.
After listening to Trump, Carol writes, at the UN, I am more convinced than ever that when Trump is handed a speech that someone else has written for him, he does not even hear the words he himself is reading. I prefer keeping him to 144 characters. Let us never give him a platform like that again. Well, he's the president, he's gonna have that platform.
The voters gave him that platform. We can't forget that.
I really don't think it. I don't think he was using his thumbs.
Oh, another digit, perhaps.
Yeah, there you go. Mark says, I feel Donald Trump is an international terrorist by virtue of his speech. Hundreds of millions are living in tremendous fear of what may happen. If this doesn't fit the definition, what does? And it's all to appease his base. Much talk about that, of a speech that went directly to his base versus the will or the interests of the United States of America.
You know, it's only in hindsight that we begin to appreciate our former presidents, be it Democrat or Republican, for taking those moments on those national stages to project not only American power, but with the common, you know, issues that all nations are usually bound by: citizenship, freedom, liberties. And here was a man who took the stage yesterday and was basically talking to the 33% of his base that elected him. It's like, when does the campaign stop?
Well, it was interesting. I have all of less than 200 followers on Twitter, but I tweeted out the President Obama's last speech to the UN General Assembly, just saying that this is just as a reminder, this is what a president of the United States is supposed to sound like. And I thought Hillary Clinton was on Colbert's show last night, and she said that she described the speech as dark, dangerous, not the kind of message that the leader of the free world should be delivering. And this is what I thought the most. It did not represent the kind of beacon of light and hope that the U.S. should be. And
no,
I thought that
no,
that's,
it did not.
Did not represent the kind of beacon of light and hope that the U.S. should be. And I thought that that was exactly right.
It represented a silo that had a flashing light above it as those rockets were about to launch.
And I also, sorry.
No, go ahead.
I noted, too, as he went around the world talking about all of the hot spots, he skipped the Ukraine and what the Russians are doing.
That's right. He had nothing to say about the Russian interference in Ukraine and the Russian interference in his own presidential election. He had they get a buy on that.
Did you hear about the South China Sea? Did you hear anything about?
Skipped it.
Not to mention climate change. No mention of climate change Well, again, I think
which
I guess is,
Macron,
again, not surprising.
Called him on that. Macron called him on the failure to being the France, called him on the fact that he didn't talk about climate change.
It all goes back to, I think, the point that was made earlier, which is you're going to need your allies. And so if you distance yourself from your allies on issues that I think you should have in common, like climate change, you know, what are they going to do when you call on them? You know, in case you do go to war and you're subjecting many Americans to that kind of danger and you call on your European friends.
But there lies the answer to your question. I mean, he's not, that speech was intended for his political base in the United States. Those are the allies he needs to survive in office. Never mind these people in other countries. We'll deal with them later. I mean, he has a fight at home to stay in power. I mean, he's alienating Republicans, he's alienating the middle, and he certainly had not had the support, of people on the left of center. And he's in a tough political situation.
What? So, real quick, Jim writes and says, "Hey, panel, you didn't hear the same speech I did. His presentation was strategically structured with philosophical roots in our traditions, and it may be for you that is out of sync. I'm proud of our president."
I will say that after listening on C-SPAN, they had an open phones line for an hour live last night, as part of the replay. And I was fascinated that to a call, every one of them was supportive of the speech because it was tough. But I think it misses the nuance.
Yeah, that's pretty good, being tough, and I guess if you're you're sitting in Albany, New York, it's great that you're tough listening to the president provoke the leader of a country that has the ability to destroy millions of lives just miles south of that leader's border. So I guess being tough from a distance is real. I don't know. That's real courage there.
Well, one of the things that's going on now is the on PBS, this amazing, very difficult to watch, but important series on the Vietnam War.
Ken Burns.
It's really stunningly powerful. And an underlying message in so much of it is how we really didn't understand the culture. And we didn't understand the country. We didn't understand the culture. We really went there not knowing what the issues were.
It was black and white. It was communism's bad, democracy's good, period.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And it occurred to me that in so much of what's going on around the world and how Trump's approaching it, it's, you know, we're repeating history of not really understanding the culture. And I think calling Kim Jong-un Rocket Man just emboldens him.
Can I just, I don't want to leave the subject without touching on this. If you look at the globe right now and you see what's happening in North Korea, right? And then you look a little bit over to the left and you see what's happening in Myanmar, right? And then you keep going
to the... Which he didn't mention at all, right?
And then and if you look over in Turkey and seeing how democracy is collapsing slowly in Turkey, right? Why then would you begin to engage in the provocation of Iran?
Right.
Why?
Right. And ignore the genocide that's going on in Yemen, for instance.
It's remarkable.
Well, yeah. It's to appeal to a piece of his base. I mean, he had Netanyahu praising him for his, criticism of Iran, and he saying he's going to basically unilaterally back out of the deal, the nuclear agreement.
But how do you do that? I mean, that's out of the barn, right? I mean, how do you do that?
What is the method to do that, right? I mean, there's no mechanism to do that.
Well, he has to re-sign by October.
That's October
21st, 20 yeah, whatever it is.
It's
in
late October.
Okay, yes. I'm impressed you just know that. So, okay, don't worry about the particular day.
There's a mechanism within the agreement that he has to re-sign on a date certain every year, every 2 years, to say that it goes forward, that they're withholding their end of the bargain, and so we'll withhold our end of the bargain. And so he's been threatening not to do that. And so that's the big question
on
the
table.
But
what happens if he doesn't, though? I mean, what's the consequence? All it does is embolden Iran to break it also. And I mean, there's no...
The interesting issue there is that he does have to certify in mid-October. But in order for him to be justified in not recertifying, is he has to claim that Iran is not living up to its end of the bargain, and he forgets that he has other people who've also signed on to that pact, including France, and France is going to be in a position to say, yes, they
You're
are.
Wrong. Right.
So he's not only alienating and stirring, you know, problems with Iran, but again, with the allies, the same allies he abandoned on the climate deal.
Right. And this was an agreement which was stitched together in UN fashion, with a range of our allies, so it would be more powerful, so it would be binding. But he's listening to Netanyahu. But look at what we're doing in Syria. I was reading a Military Times article the other day. It reminded me, because they're keeping track of how much bombing, the exponential increase in bombing, U.S. bombing in Syria in the last 2 months has been dramatic. And with that has been an exponential rise in the killing of civilians. And so what does that do? It, just breeds another generation of people who hate
Vietnam
us.
You're just talking about Vietnam and the mistakes we made in Vietnam.
Exactly.
Right?
And look at what's going into genocide in Yemen. And people can't eat. They can't eat because their fishermen can't go fish because when they go out to fish, they get bombed. And we're not doing the bombing, but they're using bombs that we paid for. And,
Let's take a break. When we come back, we will continue. We have other stories to talk about. Obviously, we want to touch on healthcare and the two major stories of Mother Nature, one being the earthquake in Mexico, and then the other being, Maria, which is hammering Puerto Rico. We'll talk about all of that when we come back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. A quick reminder that the lockbox is open, and not only is it open to get ready for the fun drive on October 16th, but we are offering tickets for Capital Steps at the Egg on November 3rd at 7:30, as well as a CD recording of that performance. For a pledge of $150, you can get a pair of tickets to go to Capital Steps, get the CD, and have a great evening. We are, I believe, almost, if not, I think, halfway through the tickets. So if you want to do this, and this is only in, 2 days? So if meaning we've only been talking about it for 2 days. So if you want to do this, I would say do it now. So
And have a good laugh over all of this stuff, because it's a good laugh.
Yes, it is a good laugh.
They're so funny.
And they can laugh at the stuff that we can laugh at, and the other stuff we'll just go home and cry over. But that's
good therapy.
Yeah.
Oh, it is unbelievable. It really helped last year.
And the other thing, too, is this is a WAMC exclusive. This concert is just being done for us, this performance. So you're going to be there with all of your fellow WAMCers. It's a benefit for us, and Alan will be a part of it. It'll be great fun, and I think this is the fourth year we've done it. They have all sold out. This one will as well, so please, we would love to hear from you. 1-800-323-9262, where you can go online at wamc.org. Help fill the lockbox, wamc.org, and thank you to everyone who has helped so far, and we do hope to see you on November 3rd. Again, WAMC.org.
So you don't have to email us. You can just in person.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Just sure. Go. Yeah. It's all good. All right. Let's move on to healthcare, because I want to get to as much of this as possible. The question is, where are we on healthcare? There has been opposition from the governors, Senate Republicans, and the White House pressed ahead Tuesday with their suddenly resurgent effort to undo President Obama's signature healthcare law, even as their attempt was dealt a setback when a bipartisan group of governors and several influential interest groups came out against the proposal. Powerful healthcare groups continued to rail against the bill, including AARP and the American Hospital Association, both of which urged a no vote. But it was unclear whether the opposition would ultimately derail the attempt, as key Republican senators, including Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, said they had yet to make up their minds. The measure marks the last gasp of Republican attempts to dramatically gut Obama's Affordable Care Act, which has added millions of people to the ranks of the insured through a combination of federally subsidized marketplaces and state-level expansions of Medicaid, leading to record lows in the number of those without health insurance. The legislation we're talking about is the Graham-Cassidy bill. It is named for Senators Lindsey Graham and Bill Cassidy. It would convert funding for the ACA into block grants for the states and would cut Medicaid dramatically over time. Again, this bill comes 2 months after a previous failed repeal effort in the Senate and is sort of a last ditch. But I don't know. They keep on calling it a Hail Mary and a last ditch, but the last two have been last ditches, right? So I don't know.
Some have called it zombie legislation.
It's the third round of a sneak attack.
Okay, so here is my question, Teresa. I know you are our healthcare expert here, so let me ask you this question, because I don't get this. But so Senator Collins, Senator Murkowski, Senator McCain all voted against the last round, the last legislation. From my reading of this, there is little or no difference in this legislation compared to that legislation, and in many cases can do more damage to the things that they were concerned about that led to their no vote. Am I right on that?
You're right in the sense that it's actually worse than the last
overall
it is this is worse than the last two, and the reason it is worse is because it totally cuts out the so right now you sign up for health care, if you know, let's say your policy costs $100, I'm making up these numbers, it costs $100, you can afford to pay $60, so you get subsidies for the other $40. And so it cuts out those subsidies, right? And what it says is, rather than give subsidies to people, we're going to block grant, we're going to take a chunk of money and we're going to give a chunk of money to the states and let the states decide how they're going to divvy up that chunk of money to provide health care for their citizens in those states. But that chunk of money gradually decreases over time, and by 2026, it's gone. So that's one thing. So after 2026, no more subsidies.
So the states will just have to pick up all the cost.
Right. And the theory is that the market, they'll get insured in the private market. But also, if it says it, employers no longer require, right now employers more than 50 employees have to provide health insurance. It says no more employer mandate and no more individual mandate that you have to have health insurance.
So it would be on us individually.
On us individually. So when that happens, then people who are sick buy health insurance, people who are well don't buy health insurance. And so then insurance is just insuring all the sick people, and that makes everybody's premiums go up. It eliminates the restrictions against charging people more or not charging people if you have pre-existing conditions, and it makes deep cuts in the Medicaid program. So a 31% cut in Medicaid for children, a 15% cut in Medicaid for seniors, it's nursing homes, people with disabilities.
So if you're Senator Collins, you're Senator Murkowski, you're Senator McCain, what is different in this legislation that would lead you to vote for this?
I think what's different is that in this Graham-Cassidy bill is that in those block grants, they have basically looked at some of these red states, and they're providing greater funding for states like Alaska, yeah, for states like Arizona, at the detriment of states like New York.
So for states who have worked hard to try to get their folks insured,
yes,
so that they have a big pool of people who are now insured who hadn't been, their block grant is not going to be sufficient to continue to pay for those people. But if you have a state that has not worked hard to get your people insured, you're going to get a block grant, and now you're going to have this new money. And so for a short period of time, you're going to be able to insure more people. Now, Susan Collins, to your point, she says last night, I have deep concerns about this, and I think our focus should be on, my focus is still on shoring up the Affordable Care Act. Murkowski is a little
wavering.
And McCain is wavering.
McCain, who had come out for this 3 weeks ago, is now wavering. But the key is last night, besides all of the healthcare groups, the AARP, the American Cancer Society, the every disease society there is, came out strong against this yesterday, but also a group of governors, Republican and Democrat, came out against it.
All right, so here's my other
question.
But it
still is going to pass.
Which is that September 30th is sort of the deadline on all of this, right? So why I don't understand Well, my understanding is that there will be no CBO score, right? There will be no Congressional Budget Office score because there isn't not enough time. But the last time we went through this, the CBO seemed to come out with a score almost overnight. So I'm wondering, why does that take so long, and why can't we get a score on it prior to the vote?
Well, there it's been with CBO for a week and a half now. It's not clear that CBO is going to be able to score it on time. It's complex because of the subsidies, because there are all sorts of ripple effects of things because of the changes that it makes. There are all sorts of things that aren't directly in the bill, but that happen. So, for instance, if you say you're going to not require people, so it won't just affect the people who are currently getting their health care through the Affordable Care Act. It's going to affect all of us, because as people lose health insurance, more people go through the emergency rooms, people with pregs. It just has a negative ripple effect that will raise everybody's premiums and making complex to score. So, but the September 30th is, I won't go through the details of why, but it's an arcane parliamentary reason why. But if they don't do it before September 30th, then you need more.
You need 60.
You need 60 votes, not 51.
And therein lies the problem that you've just articulated, but Joe raised when you started the subject. Right, we have both the Democrats as well as our media that continues to harp on these deadlines. And so, for the people who are protesting, for the people who are supporting the Affordable Care Act, they mount up this effort. And they beat it back, and there's this perception that, my goodness, we've won. Except that as long as you have the Republicans in power, and there is this effort, really, to create tax breaks, because this is exactly the issue.
Right.
That's exactly right.
They have no place to go to get those resources necessary for those tax cuts other than gutting the Affordable Care Act. So this idea that every time we get over one of these dates, like September 30th, you know, people are celebrating that this is a victory. It's like, no. The next opportunity that they have to do something, they're going to do it because they need this money in order to provide the tax breaks for the 1%.
And I think that's exactly right, that they're trying to put their tax bill on the table. They can't put it on the table because they can't figure out a way to pay for it. The Freedom Caucus says we're not with it until you show us how you're going to pay for it. The way they had planned to pay for it is with the cuts that they were going to make in health care. And so now they realize to move their tax bill forward, they need to make these cuts in health care. So,
that's sort of been the underlying part of gutting the Affordable Care Act all along.
Right. But they thought, well, now we can try other means because we didn't repeal and replace. But it's clear to them now where the rubber hits the road when they're trying to get this tax bill on the table. They don't have the money, so they're going to try to find it in healthcare.
Let's pause there. We have a lot of letters on this subject. We also want your letters, panel@wamc.org, and we have to get to news with Ray Graff, who is waiting patiently, as always, in the next room. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Wednesday morning, the 20th of September, 6 minutes past 10 o'clock. We have Mike Spain here. We have the District Attorney of Albany County, David Soares, and Communications Consultant Teresa Bourgeois making up our panel. And again, we do welcome your thoughts and letters. You can send them to us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Want to go to a couple of letters real quick, and then we'll get back into the news cycle and find other issues to talk about. But I probably want to stay with healthcare for a few moments.
Yeah, because...
Go ahead.
Call your member of Congress. Call your senator. Call every friend you know in Alaska, Kentucky.
And now, here's the other thing that I don't quite understand is that from my understanding, in the polls that have been taken, that this legislation, or probably to put it better, legislation like this that has taken to repeal Obamacare has 13% approval. 13% approval. Now, I don't know if that's accurate or not. I don't know. That's the number that they're playing with seems to be that the current bill that we have and bills before it have 13% approval from the American people.
Trump care. We'll call them all Trump care.
Okay. So my question is, if for the Republicans, even for the if they get the tax breaks and they're doing, I understand the motive. But I don't understand the politics of it, of even playing with that, when you know that most of the people, A, don't want it, and B, this is the third, fourth time around, and you haven't been able to do it. You've made the mistake once. You've made the mistake twice. Why then would you go back a third time to make another mistake?
They need the money to pay for their tax breaks for the top 1%.
Okay,
that's what's motivating this.
Well, as I said, I understand the motivation, but there also is the political issue here, right? I mean,
well, that's why they need to hear from the public, because each time they've tried to do this, there's been such a public outcry and a pushback.
But the polls are now showing that continues, and yet they still plunge forward. And I guess they have the arrogance to believe that once we give you a good tax break, this
you're
won't matter. You're going to remember that. I mean, it's politicians know that the public changes all the time, and they move on. And
the calculus is the dollars associated with their campaign coffers, and for you to provide a tax break for those people that are filling up your coffers. I mean, the gamble there is that you're going to have enough money to generally. Persuade that electorate to go your way, but you're going to focus on other issues and not necessarily healthcare, because you know it's going to be something that will cause another cultural disruption. I mean, let's not forget Karl Rove and gay marriage was the issue that got people to vote against their own self-interest.
Right.
And so I the calculation there on part of this administration is going to be, hey, look, let's give the tax break to those to to those folks who are going to fill our coffers, and then we'll find some wedge issue that we'll begin to exploit in, you know, when we the races
are. I think the rhetoric, though, I think an answer to your question, the rhetoric that the Republicans use to justify this is that we get government out of your health care.
Yep.
Of course, people love their Medicare, but they don't want government in there. We get government out of your health care. We give you a big tax break. The economy will improve. The markets will drive down the cost of delivery of health care, and then you will be better off. You'll be able to afford it better because it will cost less.
How's that going?
That's the rhetoric around it. Now, there's no economic analysis that says that that's what's going to happen, but in terms of how do they sell it?
In fact, there are economists who say that is not what's going to happen.
Exactly. Yeah. But if you want to know, Joe, how do they sell this in their own, how do they justify it to themselves and sell it to their constituencies, they sell it by saying the tax breaks will improve the economy, you'll have more money in your pocket.
Lisa Murkowski is going to have a town hall meeting, and she's at that town hall meeting, she can discuss the size of the block grant that Alaska's getting and all that they can do, you know, with the block grants. The block grants is the sugar that's sweetening the pot for them.
But the point that you make, David, which I think is an excellent point, is about this. So you have, okay, so even if they go to their districts, this has 13% approval, then they find the wedge issue that allows them to take on something and sort of forget, have the American people forget mm-hmm. what is happening, what has been ravaged by this legislation. Okay. But the two things that seem to be the wild cards in all of this are, A, you have a president who also has very poor approval ratings and has most recently been siding with Democrats. So is he going to be in your corner?
Yeah,
when
he said he'll sign it.
Well, no, I mean, but later on. whatever the issue is he going to support? Is he going to support it? And second, you don't have if you have been in power for 2 or 4 years, where you have the White House, the Senate, and the Congress, at least up until 2018. And you haven't done anything. I mean, that is devastating as well, right?
I think the bellwether for a lot of the leaders that we're talking about here is going to be Senator Jeff Flake, right, who is in a primary race right now in Arizona, who has taken, you know, a defiant stand against the president of the United States. And basically, Jeff Flake is running against Donald Trump.
Right, and they're running ads against him.
Right,
I think that's the one to watch. Yeah. That you're right.
And that decision is going to, and the results of that race is going to really send a message to the rest of our leadership, you know, and as to how they proceed and how they're going to behave moving forward, whether it's with this issue, whether it's with DACA, or anything else.
Well, so if this passes the Senate, then Speaker Ryan in the House says that he'll move this through the House quickly. Now, there's another arcane thing. Because they're all out of time to debate this, if this goes to the Senate floor, there's no time left for debate because of the vehicle which they're bringing it to the floor. So it will just come. There'll be no hearings. Well, actually, Homeland Security said that they would hold one hearing. There'll be two witnesses, Graham and Cassidy.
So that poses a very interesting issue for Senator McCain, right, who is certainly has been standing on the podium of process, right?
Right. So to meet his process, the Homeland Security Committee is going to hold one hearing. It's going to have two witnesses because he said there has to be a hearing. And then because arcane rules, again, no time for debate. They're all out of time for debate on this rule that they're bringing it up under. And so it'll just be what they call a votorama. No debate. So we're going to change a major component of our economy.
One sixth of the economy.
Right.
And then it'll go to the House. But and Ryan says he's going to move it through the House. He's got the votes, and then the president will sign it. So my question is, John Faso, Elise Stefanik, all those folks mm-hmm. who voted for it before, who have voted for this one, this does not pass the Congressman Faso, I promise the woman with brain cancer that I will protect her rule. Doesn't pass the Jimmy Kimmel rule nationally. It doesn't pass the John Faso, I promise rule.
And the governor of New York, Governor Cuomo, has said that if this passes, it will cost New York $33 billion over 10 years. Right. I mean, that's amazing.
But the flip side of it, Joe, you were asking, but, you know, what the Republicans said that they were going to do is repeal and the replace. That was their campaign pledge. Well, so it checks the box, repeal and the replace, but in a way that the public, it doesn't help the public. That's always been the problem with this rhetoric. It sounds good, but it's not good for people.
Let's go to some letters. Ruth Ellen writes, buried in the discussion of Graham Cassidy is the fact that it achieves a major goal of this administration to defund Planned Parenthood by barring it from billing for its Medicaid patients. Fully 60% of the low-income women who use Planned Parenthood as their only health care provider. True. Dan says, individual mandate forces me to be a capitalist, no thanks. No cost controls means the insurance companies are laughing all the way to the bank. Single payer only, it's a socialist thing. Caroline writes, is it even legal for Congress to introduce legislation of this magnitude and with such a widespread devastating effect without any discussion? No expert input? All-male committee limiting debate to 90 seconds from what I read, and on and on. If so, it is a travesty of our so-called democracy. Also, wouldn't there be a good chance that a bill that discriminates against blue states would be ruled unconstitutional? Mike?
No, it's perfectly legal. You know, Teresa just explained it all to us.
Unorthodox.
And a bill that punishes blue states, it's completely legal if they have the votes. It's specious. It's horrible, but it's legal.
And let me tell you the other thing. I think there's a growing chance that this will pass. But even if it doesn't, there was a process in place that was really gaining steam among a group of Republicans and Democrats on the Senate side, primarily, but also on the House side, to provide a bipartisan fix to shore up our health care system and fixing the Affordable Health Act. And this, in conjunction with Bernie Sanders introducing the single payer when he did, has really blown up that effort. And that is a crime, because we may get this.
Oh, Bernie Sanders introducing single payer is blowing up this bipartisan effort to shore up Obamacare.
It's the combination of the two.
It's not that he has the proposal. It was the timing, of when they really needed to keep people focused on building this bipartisan support. But by Cassidy on one side pushing this, and him pushing single payer.
So this is Bernie Sanders' fault, really.
No. What I'm saying is,
they've certainly used these two issues as a way to walk away from the table. I mean, both the Republican portion of that bipartisan effort certainly used the Bernie Sanders excuse to walk away from the table. But you're right. I mean, these two polar issues, these two polar things happening at the same time, and the confluence of them.
Put a strain. It pulled people apart because in introducing single payer, he denigrated the ACA, and so then the Republicans used that against him to help. It has put a strain on this bipartisan coalition building effort.
I want to get to more letters. Most of these go back to our discussion regarding the president at the UN yesterday. Robert writes, why antagonize Iran? Simple. We have never changed presidents during a war. Trump needs a war. Elaine says, at what point do we start to deal with Trump as a clear and present danger? Randy says, good morning. Trump did, in fact, make reference to the Ukraine and the South China Sea. He briefly noted them while touching on areas where borders are being threatened. Give the devil his due. John says, Trump and or his speechwriter doesn't seem to know the difference between communism and totalitarian or fascist rule. Stephen writes, Donald Trump, our madman, announcing that he would like to parade our military down Pennsylvania Avenue made me realize how much he resembles Kim Jong-un, his rocket man, than he would like to admit. Betsy says, I hope that everyone dismayed with Trump's UN speech and other policies that Trump is promulgating will view it through Putin and Russia's eyes. What would Putin think of Trump's speech? What does Russia gain from a go-it-alone USA, much less a go-it-alone Europe? Then things start to make sense for Russia with love, says Trump. Still, payback time for Trump? It may well be that Trump and his family owe Russia everything. Margie says, we are not nations, we are earthlings. We have differences among nations and cultures, it's true, but they are to be celebrated, not used to divide us. Let us think of Earthlings first. If we can do that, that would make the nuclear option unthinkable to all. You may say, I'm a dreamer.
But you're not the only one.
Very nice, Teresa. And
I'm so surprised.
Richard says, I would like to focus on Paul Ryan, Mitch McConnell, and every other Republican in Congress and see if any of them have backbone to call for what is becoming increasingly obvious. This president is unfit, and he has control of the world's most powerful nuclear arsenal. Well, we keep on saying that perhaps there's a tipping point, but we certainly haven't seen it yet, have we?
Well, Paul Manafort.
Well, it's striking the comment about us being earthlings, because it's not until you actually start thinking about the Mexicans and what they're experiencing in such a small space of time.
7.1 quake with 200 plus deaths that we know of.
And you know that number is just going to climb and climb.
And then also, you have Maria, which is now a Category 4 hurricane, and is slamming into Puerto Rico.
Harvey, Irma, Maria, Jose. We've been here, this is my fourth week, and we haven't had a conversation without having a conversation about what's happening in the islands south of us, and what's happening in some of our southern states with climate change.
On a positive note about that, even though at the UN our president didn't talk about climate change and is, getting out of the agreement, a little ways down the street today, Michael Bloomberg has organized a gathering of world leaders, among other things, to talk about climate change. And so it's a very important topic. Leaders from all over the world are coming and participating in it, so the conversation continues even though our president doesn't lead it.
What do you say to when our secretary of when people in the Trump administration say it's not the time to talk about climate change now? People are hurting. And you shouldn't bring that topic up now. We need to deal with the people who are at pain. It reminds me of the rhetoric that happens after there's a school shooting or something, and people in the NRA say it's not the time to have a conversation about gun control. It is the perfect time to have a conversation about climate change, don't you think?
I have never, not in my lifetime, have I seen an administration that is so void of any credibility. I mean, if we're not talking about if we're not talking about that particular individual who made that comment, then there is, plenty to talk about with Betsy DeVos.
Yeah.
and her comments about Title IX. And I mean, I'm in the business, okay?
Right, right.
I'm in the business, and we have
enforcing
the
law, right?
Wonderful universities in our own backyard, and we have our issues. And the idea that she is the head of that department for our country, and saying this, it smacks people like me in the face, not to mention the thousands of victims who don't report these crimes for specifically that reason. But I'm off subject here, because what we're talking about is the climate.
We're talking about credibility.
Credibility.
Well, I read Military Times, and I read.
Why? Yeah. I'm not judging you. I'm just curious why.
Oh, it's great. You learn, because I think that we forget that there's
Soldier of Fortune. Do you read Soldier of Fortune?
No. Okay,
that's a different publication.
Okay, very different publication.
All right, just checking.
But, watch your back.
But I think it's very easy that only a very small percentage of American families are involved in the military, and I think it's easy to lose sight of what they're going through. And if you read the Military Times, then you keep up on their perspective of what's going on in the world. That's why I read it. Okay.
Well, I'm impressed that you do. I'm not.
It's great. You should at least skim it once
All
a
right,
week.
I will.
Anyway, they have something called Medals and Misfires, the editorial board, and I was shocked and fascinated to see that they gave a medal, as opposed to a misfire, to the Pentagon for finding their way around the Trump directive on climate change. And they say Trump's executive order could have completely squashed this review, but kudos to the brains of the Pentagon stepping aside the whole "is climate change real?" and rather they're talking about potential risks. Anyway.
You will have the last word on that. We are out of time, but I thank you. I thank David. Mike, thank you very much. We will continue with the roundtable after this.